Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes, and this is the audio diary of my life. It's the 23rd today. It's a Wednesday, 23rd of October 2000, as I say, 24, and it's dark. It's just after 7 in the morning. I'm going to have a little slurp here to ease my throat of a nice coffee. Let me just change my lights because this light is too bright on this dark day. These some of these electric lights that you buy. It's a horrible light. I do like a slightly warmer light. Oh, they're sort of a stark light, these. And they're not really good for you. The coloration is not really good for you, I don't believe. It's cold as well in the house. Not freezing cold. Not as cold as it could be, but it's certainly not warm. We're in October, I suppose. So what do you expect? Julia was not with me last night. She had to stay at home. I think she's thinking of going to her parents at the weekend, but I haven't even looked that far to see what's going on in my diary. I've got three interviews to do. I believe I am being interviewed at 6 and 2 others in the day. Yesterday I did manage to get some writing done. 2 bits of writing, so that was good. So I felt good about that. I do want to concentrate on the book and other things now, moving away from the interviews. As much as the interviews are interesting, I'm I've been stuck for 2 years in a time and a place, you know, having to do these interviews day after day after day, even though it's at home, and I feel I need to move about and do other things. I'm just looking in the diary. Here we are, Jeffrey Grigson. He must have, and on some of these, there's a series of one entry for these dates today, October to 23. We just have Gilbert White in 1768 in Hampshire saying, "Fallows in a sad, wet, weedy condition, scarce any wheat sown." That was. I suppose must have been a wet year, or weedy. I guess weeds managed to get through. I have got an interesting book to share with you that came yesterday. It's absolutely fascinating, beautiful book. I was advised that it was coming. I was asked by the author, and I'd forgotten that it was coming. So it was a lovely surprise. We'll look at that in a moment. I have also got to go. Excuse me. I was charge up my radio mics this morning, and I'm just looking to see where the leads are. I think one's. Oh yes, I think they're. I think I know where they are. I keep misplacing all these USB leads because I use them for one thing and then for something else. I'm just going to. Here we go. I need 3, you see, for the radio mics, because, there we go, I meant to put them on yesterday, but I'll try and get them on this morning so that they might be charged before I do my monologue on the show. So having spotted the radio mics, which I left downstairs here to do that, it's a Wednesday and it's not luckily bin day, because I'm not quite ready for bin day. Tomorrow is bin day, so just bear with me, I'm just plugging them in. I don't want them to run out of battery, that's the thing. I've got to change the camera battery around as well. Some days it's kind of, today's battery day. I feel like a hen. There's one, and here is the t'other. I said I needed three. That's actually a mistake. I only needed two, one for the microphone, one for the receiver. Microphone transmitter and one for the receiver. I was thinking, I have another set. And that one has two microphones and one receiver. And that's where you need the third. Right, I can't do anything about the camera battery until I get the camera out. So, I'm hoping I changed my insurance on the van. So I'm now insured by somebody else because they were charging me so much on the renewal. I mean, it was totally ridiculous what the prices have gone up. So I found somewhere else which was marginally cheaper. And then they sent me a thing saying, oh, we need proof of your no claims bonus. And I said, well, I don't, how do I get that? I don't have, I mean, I had over 9 years no claims. I haven't claimed, well, I haven't really had an accident for like 20 years. So, and so I thought, well, how do you do that? And I wrote to the old insurance company that I hadn't renewed with, and they said, well, once yours has elapsed, we will send you the no claims bonus. I said, oh, okay, that's all right. And so my new one starts yesterday, and my old one finished yesterday. So I'm expecting in the post, I suppose, a no claims bonus that I can then send. I think I can scan it and email it to the new insurer. It's all very complicated, isn't it? And it's really bizarre, I think, you know, the car license, the rules and regulations on the road. Go back 100 years, you didn't need a license. You didn't need, there weren't all these road regulations. Now, I understand that you need some, what would you say, guidance. But everything is has to be registered and in the legal system. And it's fascinating when you realise, of course, that all of that's a bit of a scam, because effectively you're giving away a title or you're acquiescing to a certain responsibility. And you say, well, what if I don't register it and drive? Ah, well, you're driving illegally. Yes, OK, I'm driving illegally, but I'm driving lawfully if I'm not doing any harm. And these two jurisdictions sit side by side, but the legal one sits on top of a higher authority. And if you obey the higher authority, in theory, the legal one has no jurisdiction. It's only if you agree to be in that jurisdiction. Trouble is, the legal one now thinks that it's the boss and it has the big sticks with the police, the judges and everybody else. And this has got to be cracked, that you have a private plate and you have nothing to do with them. And somewhere, I mean, people do seem to do this, but it does seem that, like so much of the going against the system, they don't like it because they want to control you. Well, you know, we do need to push back because this control has gone too far, far too far. It's no longer fit for purpose, I would say. Problem is that many of the people enforcing stuff these days have no notion that there is a lawful jurisdiction that is above the legal one. Anyway, so this book that I got by a chap called Chris Dobson is an unusual book for me, but it was sent to me. It's a very beautiful book, I have to say. It's a nice A4 size glossy covered hardback, very lovely book. It's a lovely piece of work. Although there is a spelling on the spine error that Julia noticed. But I think this is only an approval version. I'm surprised, actually, whoever produced this book did not spot it themselves. It's called Beaten Black and Blue. The Myth of the Medieval Knight in Shining Armour by Chris Dobson. The premise of this book, and it's based on years of research, this chap, Chris Dobson, is a hands-on master craftsman who, it says here, established in 1985 a studio to reconstruct and restore arms and armour. He is a unique in the museum world, not only having the hands-on experience of an artist and master craftsman, but also doing academic research and curatorial work for public museums and private collections as an art historian. In 1995, Chris's scholarly approach to his craft led to his appointment as Master Armourer to the Royal Armouries. He's over 30 years' experience as an armourer and expert restorer of armour and edged weapons. Over the years, he's been a regular lecturer at the Wallace Collection, London, and he was director of the two international arms and armour conferences in Florence. He now writes books and produces podcasts about Italian art and history. So, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And he's written this book. The premise of this book is the notion at which he dispels. Well, I'll read it to you because I think it's fascinating and I have no reason, of course, to doubt him. He says... At first, I mean, he said, welcome readers, blah, 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 something I've been wanting to do, etc., etc., in his introduction. He says here, when discussing the findings that would eventually become this book, I was worried that someone else might beat me to it and publish first. But actually, I was surprised to find that my proposal was met with real resistance. What I found was that the image of the polished white armour in weapons as being the standard equipment for all types of warriors throughout the European Middle Ages and early Renaissance, was so deeply ingrained in the 21st century concept of that historical period that people didn't want to consider that their understanding of history might actually be fundamental misunderstanding of the evidence that was staring them in the face. My intention writing this book is therefore to dispel that misunderstanding. So, spoiler alert, living history enthusiasts who may be lovingly polishing their reproduced plate armour in readiness for the next season's events might want to stop reading now, or at least put down that polishing cloth. But those who can bear to keep reading will find that it will be very well worth their while if they want their equipment to have an authentic finish. However, you shouldn't think that these finishes can be achieved with the sort of chemical solution sold for colouring firearms. The colour oxide finishes that I'm going to describe in this book were born from the manufacturing techniques used to create the objects themselves in a forge. And while I will also be dealing with painted, varnished, fabric-covered surfaces, the bulk of this book is about colour oxide finishes, and that should also be of particular interest to museum creators and conservatives. He goes on with a big warning about don't try this at home, it's extremely dangerous, and he, you know, says he won't, accepts no responsibility. What he's saying in this book, the fundamental principle is the knight in white shining armour, and by white, not painted white, but polished silver, polished to an nth of its life, is a myth. It never was. It didn't happen. And as a restorer, I read some of it yesterday, as a restorer, he takes armour, ancient armour, apart. And it says, you know, most of this armour was remelted down, reused, changed, adapted, and what have you. So there's very few genuine first editions, as it were. But those that he comes across, and weapons that he's come across, he, in taking it down, in the tiny seams, the bits that don't get seen in daylight, that overlap, that those bits that have not been changed, adapted, polished, or anything like that, you see the remnants of its original finish. And when you put that together with some of the paintings, that you understand how paintings of that period worked, you get a completely different story of what the armour looked like. And with these oxide finishes, which is to do with heating in a forge, you attain amazing colour, or dulled colour, not shining necessarily colour, but a variance of colour, including purples, greens, bronzes, reds, browns, yellows, and so on. And but not just a uniform colour, but patterns, beautiful patterns on the metal itself. And whereas we think that the knights all wore this either bright silvery white colour or a darker colour, just dull, some of his work is amazing. And you look at some of these beautiful pictures, and they've got stripes, they've got wiggly lines, they've got incredible patterns. But the metal is, there's blues, beautiful blues. I'm just looking at some of these pictures, at the helmets, breastplates, shin covers, neck covers, and so on. And yes, so you get a completely different idea of what armour would have looked like. And it shows to me, just looking through this and the way he's compared from one thing to another, colour of the old days. Colour, it seems, was just something that people relished. And of course, nature is full of colour. And you know, reddish purples on this, on the metals, and as I say, greens and turquoises, and but patterns, beautiful patterns. I mean, absolute works of art. Blue blades, amazing. Just, you know, you start to see these things pop, as it were, as they say, pop into life. Not colour as in, I mean, beautiful, subtle colours as well. Not colour as in, you know, what would you call, like, glossy, bright, cartoon-like colours. Not that sort of thing. But, you know, gold bands that are a bit rusticated or mottled. I suppose that's the word I'm looking for. It's very difficult to explain all these things. The handles of things and the dyes of the clothes. But absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing, this. So he goes on, I mean, I haven't read a huge amount, but it goes on here to say things like, the other thing about restoration work is it teaches you how colour finishes, if not scrubbed away entirely, changing over time, so that when you see a piece with the surface in a certain state of corrosion or with a certain patina, you have a fair chance of knowing what you may find between the plates or underneath rivets. But even then, sometimes you get a real surprise. At all times, when reading these signs, it's very important to do so from the clear understanding of whether or not the piece has been reworked during its lifetime or worked upon later as a museum or private collection long after it was in use. And here I believe begins the story of the misconception of what we have been labouring under. Personally, I blame those great restorers of the Victorians for most part, although it has to be said that even the finest museums were undergoing changes to their appearance long before that. The Gothic revival, however, heralded the craze for collecting medieval arms and armour that did the real damage. And both armour and weapons were polished up to conform to the current taste, sometimes resulting in the complete grinding off of hammered finished surfaces to make pieces more attractive to buyers or prettier when displayed on the walls of a stately home or castle. While at the Tower of London, soldiers stationed there were kept busy by being given a cloth and some brick dust and were told to polish up the armour in the White Tower. This taste for polished armour and weapons has continued right up to the present day, and very, very few pieces have escaped unscathed, even in the most prestigious collections. So, as I shall demonstrate, just because you're used to seeing the most famous pieces of arms and armour with polished white surfaces from innumerable photos in books and on the internet, you shouldn't assume that's what they looked like when they were new. Absolutely lovely, a lovely book. I mean, I would never have thought I would have been that bothered or interested in armour. But when it changes your perception, chapter here with a beautiful plate, photographic plate in colour of a suit of armour, and it says sanguine, peacock blue and bronzed. And you can see just about, you can see in this peacock blue base colour, which is done, this however it's done, in the oxide colouring of the metal, a natural colouring, I think. And then this bronze, beautiful picture, well, swirling leaves, I suppose you might call it, like a plant growing from the groin up the chest, almost like a tree or a plant with swirling branches and interesting leaves, all in bronze. And then these, so almost like a tattoo. It's almost like a tattoo. And this beautiful, you know how when you heat metal up, it changes colour into these different things. This is what I'm getting from this. It's totally stunning, and it's utterly beautiful. Such craftsmen must have cost an absolute fortune. Back in chapter 2, I said sanguine armour had become largely associated with etched and gilded pieces of the 16th century, and I opened this chapter with some famous examples around the end of that century. The foot combat armour for the Barriers, one of the group of 12 made by Anton Pfeffenhauser and commissioned in 1591 by Sophie of Brandenburg as a Christmas gift for her husband, Christian I, Prince Elector of Saxony, who reigned in 1586 to 1589, is a superb example of a hardened and tempered steel armour, given that finish, Fig 196, which is the one I just described to you. Later, this vivid coloured finish was used on fine sword blades of the 18th and 19th century, where it often survives in very good condition. The Spanish name for this iridescent blue-purple finish is pavon, or peacock blue, and we will see how it got its name shortly. Absolutely, I mean, it's just stunning. It's a beautiful book. Well, if you've got time, you know, to read it. But anyway, I don't know whether it's out. This is, it was published 2 years ago, so it must be out, must be available. But what I was sent was a revised, or I think a press copy or something that he put together. So presumably these have gone around museums and various places and all of that. But just fascinating. That's what I love about books. People have got to read books. They've got to get books, because books tell a story that perhaps the internet and perhaps, you know, the sloppy writing doesn't have. Books are, to me, they are such wonders. And people's work, people's life's work is encapsulated between the covers, the two hardboard covers of you know, a number of pages, 100, 200 odd pages, of which you can give time and thought to. Well, I think that's it for now. I am sitting here in my dressing gown. I will go and get myself dressed and have a shave and start cracking on with everything else I have to do today. But thank you for listening if you did. I think that it is now light outside, which is a blessed relief. I will upload this, and hopefully you enjoy it, and hopefully it surprises you a little. It surprised me, actually. Until next time, bye for now.